MacCast, Monday, April 22nd, 2013. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, I got a good show for you today. We got some more iPhone, iPad speculation stuff to get to. Still a lot of rumors floating around out there about what Apple is going to do next. We also have to talk a little bit about the craziness that is going into leading up to Apple's next quarterly results call. A lot of people speculating that Apple is not doing what they need to do, that iPhone sales may be dropping. And we'll get into that a little bit and look at some of the reasons why I think a few of the rumors are a little bit overblown or people are panicking a little bit prematurely. But we've got that to get to. Plus, I have a really great interview with someone who's going to talk to us about the ebook digital learning revolution. If you remember way back when Apple came out with iBooks Author and they had a whole special event around e-textbooks and e-learning and stuff like that. And we never really saw, I think, or haven't seen yet that revolution happening. But I think a lot of us still think it's coming. And I had a chance to meet a guy who really believes in that, works for a company and with a company that also believes in that vision. And we're going to talk about why that didn't happen quite yet or hasn't quite happened yet and what they're doing to help push forward or drive forward the digital learning revolution. So stay tuned for all of that. But before we get into it, I'm going to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that's ShareFile by Citrix. You know, it's not only what we do at work, but how we do our work that can make a difference. And one thing is for sure, you don't want to waste a lot of time and energy dealing with trying to get at your critical documents and files. The flow of information that you need access to, that we need access to, needs to be continuous. It needs to be ongoing. We're working collaboratively, and we want that to be time efficient. And whether you're at an office or you're on the go, like many of us are now, we're not physically at the office, we still need access and quick, easy, efficient access to those critical files and documents so that we can all get things done. And ShareFile helps you do all of that and more easily and securely. ShareFile by Citrix seamlessly integrates into your daily routine no matter where you are, from any kind of device, mobile device, laptop. You can get access to the files you need. And with ShareFile, files of almost any size can be sent as secure links. So that means you're not going to waste time with email and lost attachments and all that sort of stuff. Plus, you get notifications sent to you when items are open so you can track their progress, you can see who is working on things, and your files can be password protected and controlled so you can make sure they're getting to the people that need to see them and not being seen by those who don't. Plus, you can set up things like shared folders for easy collaboration, working with clients or other coworkers. It's very flexible and very business focused. Plus, you get really great support. It is a professional tool. You get a dedicated account manager. They're going to help you set up and give you support with ShareFile, and that will really change the way you work. So to help you get started, I have a special 30-day free trial. There's no obligation. You can take advantage of it right away and really see the difference that ShareFile can make in your workflow, in your business. So to get my special offer, just go to ShareFile.com today. Click on the little radio microphone up at the top of the homepage and enter my promo code MACCAST. That's ShareFile.com, and type in my code MACCAST to get started on your free 30-day trial today. And a big thank you to ShareFile and Citrix for their support of the MacCast. So there continues to be a lot of continued speculation on what the next generation of the iPhone is going to look like. This week, a site called Tactus, who makes cases, claimed to have images showing the low-cost iPhone's back shell. So we've been hearing that Apple's going to have the iPhone 5S plus a new low-cost iPhone coming out. And on this one, they show just the white back, but the site claims that Apple suppliers are working on multiple colors. There would be black, white, blue, red, and yellow versions. If the part is real, the new low-cost iPhone in terms of dimensions would be slightly shorter, but wider and thicker than the current generation iPhone. The actual dimensions they're reporting are 4.72 inches tall, that's 120 millimeters, 2.44 inches to 2.56 inches wide, that's 62 to 65 millimeters wide, and 0.35 or about 9 millimeters thick, so slightly thicker than the current generation iPhone 5. The site also claims to have specs on the new device that tend to make me doubt a little bit its validity. They say that it's going to feature a 32 nanometer A5 processor. That would be a little bit lower than I would think. I would think Apple would want to stick with the A6, but they could possibly be doing that to save costs, to cut those costs down. They also, though, then claim that it will have a 3.5 inch Retina display. And I think that's not likely because Apple, starting in May, starting on May 1st, is requiring that all apps and any app updates submitted to the App Store support a 4-inch Retina display. So I really think that Apple's going to want to standardize on that being the minimum display size, a 4-inch Retina, moving forward. Of course, they could, you know, go ahead and use the 3.5 inch display, maybe again to save a little bit of cost, but I still kind of feel that's a little bit unlikely. And then the other spec they claim the new low-cost iPhone will have is that it'll have a 5-megapixel camera. I think that's very likely. That's a common component they've been using for a while now. I think it's good enough for a lower-cost iPhone. It takes very nice pictures, and that, again, will keep the costs in line with where Apple needs to hit them. The site also claims that the new iPhone 5S will feature an A7 processor, but I don't think that component is going to be ready. We've been hearing these rumors that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing Corporation is going to be the supplier for the new A7 chip, that they'd be using their new 20 nanometer process, but we've also heard that they're not going to be ready to go into production with that technology until the first quarter of 2014. And so that puts the low-cost iPhone and the iPhone 5S a lot further out than I think we would see them. Most of the reports we've been hearing are saying that the new iPhones are going to be here in the fall, probably around the October time frame. And so that processor just isn't going to be ready. I would think that Apple would stick with an A6, A6X style processor, maybe a slightly tweaked version of that, in the next generation iPhone and not wait for the A7. Overall, in terms of pricing, we're hearing that the low-cost iPhone is expected to be somewhere in the range of about $300 US for an unlocked device, which would be a great price point for Apple to hit and I think would boost sales. You know, I've talked about the fact that I think the iPhone line at this point is mature enough to have Apple start expanding it out in terms of different price points, different variations. We've been hearing these things about maybe a larger screen size on the iPhone 5S, Apple moving to more of a form factor in line with some of their competitors. I'm not so certain I'd want to see that, but I could see that sort of thing happening. We've also been hearing about multiple screen sizes. Again, I think Apple's going to standardize on a 4-inch Retina screen, but I wouldn't be shocked if that did change. I just personally feel that they're going to just stick with that 4-inch size. But we'll have to wait and see. We might be waiting a little bit longer than expected, though, because many of us thought Apple would have a new iPhone out this summer, in the summer time frame, but more and more it's looking like they're going to stick with that fall release schedule for a new iPhone. There's also more speculation on the next generation iPad, this time from KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo. He's at it again, this time offering speculation on Apple's next 9.7 inch iPad. He claims that the next version of Apple's full-size tablet will be 15% thinner and 25% lighter. Not only that, he says it'll charge faster thanks to a smaller 8,500 to 9,000 milliamp hour battery. I assume they're going to go with a smaller battery to get the weight down and to make it thinner. And also, they'll use more efficient processors and technology to keep the iPad's battery life consistent with the current generation iPad. Typically, Apple's not going to go down on battery life. So if they squeeze a smaller battery in there, something that's going to charge faster, they're going to have to still deliver on that. And they'll have to make up the difference someplace else, probably in the display technology that they use, and also, again, the processor. It's my understanding that Kuo gets most of his intelligence from some pretty good connections within Apple's supply chain, and he has a fairly good track record on his accuracy, so I tend to believe some of the stuff that he puts out a little bit more. The thing here, though, is he's also claiming that the iPad will run an A7X processor, probably a quad-core processor. He thinks it's going to be built on a 28-nanometer design still being produced by Samsung. And that's where the whole thing gets a little bit weird to me, because some think that we might see the iPad as early as WWDC in June. And if a WWDC announcement happens and it has an A7X processor, that means that the A7X in the iPad would be out before an A7 processor in the iPhone, and that sort of reverses things on us. Kuo actually is predicting that the iPad will release sometime in August or September, so more in that fall time frame, but that still would put an A7X chip in our hands before an A7, and that really is reversed from what we're used to. As Cult of Mac points out, though, it might not be that strange, because really the main difference between the X and the non-X variants of Apple's A-series chips is the graphics cores, and the AX chips tend to have more cores to support the larger iPad Retina screens. And so Apple could certainly flip those things around. It just would be a deviation from what we've normally seen. And the new iPad is also expected to be thinner. It's expected, as we've talked about, to support more iPad mini-like materials. So the black slate back, the aluminum back on the white version, and also the thinner bezels on the sides. That rumor keeps cropping up over and over again, and I think that's very likely that Apple's going to move in that direction. So we're expected to see those units hit again, depending on who you want to believe, either June or later in the fall. As I mentioned earlier, we're coming up on Apple's next quarterly results call, and there has been a lot of speculation and a lot of signs this week that claim to show iPhone sales are dropping fast, and it's expected that Apple is going to have a kind of mixed results in this next quarterly results call. As far as the proof that Apple might be seeing dropping iPhone sales, the first came when Cirrus Logic, who supplies the audio chips for the iPhone, gave some guidance that it had to take an inventory charge for the March quarter because of a decreased forecast for a high-volume product for a customer who they said is migrating from one of Cirrus Logic's, or migrating to one of Cirrus Logic's newer components. The translation of that by analysts was that basically Apple didn't need as many chips for the iPhone in March, and that is a sign that sales might be slowing down. Then DigiTimes came and reported that iPad mini shipments are going to decline 20-30% in the current quarter. They say this comes from checks with suppliers like LG, and the report claims that LG's iPad mini parts deliveries will only be around 3.5 million units in the current quarter. That's versus the 5 million units that they shipped in March. They also say that May and June shipments will be even lower than that, coming in somewhere around 3 million units. Now, in my mind, this could just mean that Apple is caught up with demand of the iPad mini, so they had sort of ramped up production and had high volume orders in that 5 million range, and now they're achieving this kind of stasis in the cycle, and that is slowly winding down before they ramp up the next generation components for an iPad mini update, which, as we noted earlier, many of us are expecting to happen sometime in the fall. So this could be a normal cycle, but at the moment, it seems like a lot of analysts are reading into this that Apple has declining sales on the iPad as well as the iPhone. And then not long after the DigiTimes report, LG Display themselves came out and announced that they had a 74% drop in quarterly earnings. And since 30% of the company's profits actually come from Apple's display orders, it's been assumed that at least a portion of the profit loss is due to decreased orders from Apple. Once again, the analyst translation of this is that iPhone and iPad sales are declining. Now, all of this has led to the belief that when Apple does have their quarterly earnings call on Tuesday, April 23rd, that net income will be down for the first time in a decade. As a matter of fact, Reuters is predicting revenue of $42.49 billion with earnings per share of $10.07. That would actually be about an 8% rise in revenue, but an overall 18% decline in net income from a year ago. And the reason is this assumption that due to new products being in the lineup that have a lower profit margin, that is having an impact on net income, and also, again, slowing demand of what most feel is the iPhone. We've heard a little bit on the iPad front, as noted earlier as well. But despite the revenue decline, iPad and iPhone sales are being predicted to have hit record numbers. So once again, it's more on that lower profit margin. Probably also a little bit, we're kind of hearing that iPhone 5S sales, which would have the higher profit margin on the iPhone side, that those were a little bit slower. And I would assume the overall iPhone numbers hitting record units is going to have a lot to do with iPhone 4S and iPhone 4 sales ramping up, especially internationally in some of the markets that are a little bit more cost sensitive, which could be another reason why we're hearing so many rumors of Apple maybe expanding the line to include a newer, lower cost iPhone, drive unit sales up, maybe not have as much profit margin on the iPhone, but kind of make up the difference in volume. And again, I think the iPhone has hit that maturity state where it makes sense for Apple to diversify in that direction. And I think that's exactly what we're going to see them do this year moving forward. And what has really started to drive me nuts about all this speculation about Apple and iPhone sales slowing down and things like that is that we seem to be getting a lot of contradictory numbers. And the other thing I've learned is that I really just don't understand Wall Street and analysts. I think I've talked to a couple people, and I think a lot of the reasons we've been seeing Apple's stock price fluctuate and actually move mostly in the down direction lately is that investors really want to see more dividends being paid out, and they are a little bit nervous about Apple and their product lineup moving forward because Apple has suddenly become really aloof about when they're going to bring out their next products. We haven't seen anything from them. We haven't seen anything new from them in a while. I think they're working on a lot of stuff, and I think we're going to get hit with a bunch of big announcements, but nobody really knows when it's going to happen. And I think that's making everybody really nervous. But the funny thing, and the thing that confuses me, is that overall, if you look at how Apple is doing financially and the kinds of money that they're making and how much money they have on hand, they're doing incredibly well compared to most other tech companies, and certainly compared to most other PC companies and smartphone manufacturers, you know, in their field, in their industry. And all the focus seems to be on unit numbers and market share, and why that is continues to baffle me. And I guess I'll never quite understand it, but what I do understand is that companies who make more profit tend to stay around longer than ones who don't. And that is a metric that says to me, at least for now, that we shouldn't have to fear too much for Apple not having the most in terms of unit sales or market share. And there were a ton of examples this week that came out that just sort of prove this to me over and over again. And I just scratch my head and go, I don't understand what investors want or are looking for. You look at numbers from, say, like a Simco. They came out and they said that Apple has 5% of the worldwide PC market share, but they earn 45% of the profit on the computers that they make. They also pointed out that Apple has a 72% share of all mobile phone profits, and that's with just about a 7% share of the mobile phone market, at least according to recent numbers from Gartner. So they're making a ton of money off of the products that they sell. So does it really matter that they only have 5% or 7% of the market when they're earning that much more of the profit? Verizon this week reported that 55% of their first quarter smartphone activations were iPhones, and that about 50% of those were iPhone 5S models. And I'll just take an aside here and point out that that number may actually be why we're expected to see this that slight profit loss or a net income loss for Apple in the current quarter, because it sort of shows that iPhone 5S sales might not be as strong as some of the older iPhone 4 and 4S sales out there. And since those devices are now selling for less, I would assume that there's a slightly reduced profit margin in those devices. And then on the App Store front, App Annie's market report for the first quarter of 2013, that showed that Apple's App Store is actually generating 2.6 times more revenue than the Google Play Store, and that's on roughly the same download volume. Now, I will point out on the Google Play side that the same report noted that Google Play had a yearly increase in app revenue of 90%, so they did get a significant uptick in the volume of sales or profit that they're making from the downloads over there, but Apple is still beating them handily in terms of overall revenue. Canalysis had similar numbers. They reported that Apple had about 40% of app downloads, but that they were generating 74% of app revenues. And then Opera MediaWorks for iOS products said that 44.53% of all mobile ad traffic was garnered by Apple, and that of that, 49.23% of ad revenue was made by Apple. So Apple's making almost 50% of all of the mobile ad revenue, according to, again, Opera MediaWorks. And then don't forget usage numbers. We've seen really weird things in terms of usage of iOS devices versus Android devices and other smartphones, where Apple seems to have this larger percentage of actual usage despite having a smaller percentage of the overall market share. Net market share, for example, their latest numbers showed that 61% of browsing on mobile devices happens on iOS. This is for March 2013. Now, StatCounter, which is another thing that tracks web usage, their numbers contradict this a little bit. They showed that Android had 37.2% of the market, and that iOS only had 27.1%. That was also for March of 2013. So I take those numbers with a grain of salt. I don't know how to sort of rectify the two against each other, but they're both out there. And then Chitika came back, and just for iPads, their numbers seem to show that that in tablets, Apple has 81.9% of the U.S. and Canadian tablet web traffic. So a much higher percentage versus Android. Now, again, that's not globally. And we do know that globally, Android devices, especially on the tablet side, at least according to the numbers I've seen, are not quite in the majority yet. They are a little bit more balanced than they are than they tend to be in the U.S. So we need to factor that in when we're looking at these numbers. But overall, it does show that Apple still has a pretty big advantage when it comes to usage, and an even bigger advantage when it comes to profit share in these different areas. And to me, that seems to go direct to the bottom line. That's why Apple has so much cash on hand. And I know that a lot of people, and I firmly believe this, believe that the stock would be sliding a lot quicker if Apple didn't have that big cash reserve. So luckily they have that. I think at this point, most people on Wall Street are just waiting to see what Apple is going to do. And many this week are calling and saying that Apple does need to do something soon, or they're going to continue to sort of see this drop. And it's going to be interesting to see what happens after this next quarterly results call. Typically, after a quarterly results call, I think Apple's stock drops a little bit further even before sort of ramping back up. And it'll be interesting to see if that trend changes this time around, and if maybe investors jump in right after, and we see the stock price go up a little bit more right after it. But again, I don't even pretend or begin to understand how that stuff works. And I know some of you do, and I appreciate it when you sort of clue me in and send me emails and send me your thoughts. And like I said, I know a lot of people have already told me that if Apple would just increase their dividends, they're a little bit, I guess, below industry standard at this point, and if they could bring it back up in line with some of their competitors, that they might see an uptick in the stock. But I don't think it's going to be a huge uptick. I think for that to happen, it's going to really take Apple bringing out another revolutionary product. And I think at this point, many people feel that's not going to happen this year, that we're not going to see the iWatch. We're not necessarily going to see a new TV. Apple might not hit a new market. We'll see updated products at some point, although Apple seems to be even delaying those. This whole first quarter has been really rough in terms of seeing anything new from Apple. And most of the rumors we're hearing now are pinpointing updates happening sometime in the fall. I don't know where those new pro systems are. So I think a lot of us are just feeling like we're in the dark, and that's something that hasn't happened for a really long time. And I don't even know. In the back of my mind, I'm just going to throw this out there, and you tell me what you think. In the back of my mind, we had that thing like last year where Tim Cook said, hey, we're going to double down on our security. I'm thinking maybe this is just all part of that, and that Apple does have some big announcements up its sleeve that we might hear about really soon. WWDC seems a logical time for Apple to do something, and we may just be blown away and shocked at how they fooled us and kept us in the dark this time around, and maybe that's what's going on. That would be really cool to see, and I hope it happens for Apple's sake, but we're just going to have to hang in and wait and see what they do. And then finally, in the news for this week, we got a little more information on what Apple is doing with all the data that Siri is collecting, and more specifically, how long they're holding on to it. And it may shock you. I know it shocked me to find out that they keep that stuff for 2 years. Apple has told Wired magazine that the data you send to Siri is kept for up to 24 months. This is the recorded vocal interactions that you have with Siri. So when you push that button, it records the audio, it sends that up to Apple's servers, and then it sends your responses back. They're keeping that data. It's important to note that they do anonymize that. And exactly how was uncovered in this article. They say basically it's captured and assigned a random number that's generated just for the Siri interaction. And that number is not associated with your Apple ID, your name, your email, or any kind of other personal identifying information. The anonymous data could be used to track you, but it really would require a pretty complex forensic analysis of the information to sort of track it back to you. And the data that has the random number on it is stored for 6 months along with that random number, and then according to the report is disassociated from the number after 6 months and then stored for another 18 months. So you have a total of 2 years, but only 6 months with that anonymized number. And once that's been thrown away, even with forensic analysis, according to the report, you couldn't get back at figuring out where the information came from originally. And as far as why Apple is holding on to that information, they say they keep it for data analysis and to help them improve the Siri system. And then after the 2 years, that data is completely deleted. So that's what's going on with the Siri data. If the fact that Apple holds on to that data and has even that anonymized number associated with it bothers you a little bit or freaks you out, what you can do is just simply turn Siri off, because according to the report, when you do that, the random identifier and the data associated with it is deleted immediately and would be wiped away. So you could do that, and then you could just turn Siri back on. It, of course, would start collecting the information again, but you can toggle Siri on and off as often as you like. So if you want to, you could probably wipe it out every day, and Apple wouldn't have the retention of that information, at least according to the report from Wired magazine. So thought that was interesting to note this week. But that's all I have for you this week on the news. Before we move on, I do want to take a quick moment and thank another one of our show sponsors. And that's Smile, makers of PDF Pen and PDF Pen Pro. The new versions, version 6, are out now, and in my opinion, they take an already amazing product and make it even more amazing. If you deal with PDFs at all, and I think all of us do at some point. You're going to get a PDF. If you get PDFs, if you open them, you use them, you need to work with them, you need to own a copy of PDF Pen, in my opinion. You can use it to annotate and edit your PDFs. You can add signatures. That's something I do all the time. I've gone totally digital with my documents, and it makes that process so easy. You can use it to perform OCR on your scanned documents, making them easy to search. You can password protect your PDFs, so if you have sensitive information in there, you can manage your PDFs with Dropbox and Evernote integration, so you can sync things up, you can take them with you, and if you get the version on the App Store, it now has iCloud integration, so you can work with iCloud and your PDFs and PDF Pen to keep everything in sync. And plus, this update has a whole new look that's optimized for Retina displays, and the redesign looks incredible. It gives you quicker and easier access to all the items and tools you need to work with, and I absolutely love the new toolbar. I think it really makes me much more productive when I'm working within the application. And it has incredible new power features as well. You now have the ability to export and convert your PDFs to Microsoft Word formats. This works incredibly well. I was blown away with how well this works. So if you need to edit your PDFs, you want to turn it into a Microsoft Word document, you can do that from inside PDF Pen. And it uses the Nuance OmniPage Cloud Document Conversion Service, so it just works amazingly well. And if you get the Pro version, you can now automatically analyze your PDFs and your PDF forms and turn those, what we call fake forms, you know, the things where you have a PDF that looks like it has fill-in fields, but they really don't work. You can automatically convert those to fill-in forms, and that saves a ton of time. I have a document that I work on with a client, and I constantly am having to convert these fake forms into real forms, and having that ability just saves me a ton of time. So don't wait. Right now is the time to grab a copy of PDF Pen. If you don't have it yet for your Mac, you can get it on the Mac App Store. You can get it through Smile's website. And if you already own PDF Pen and you haven't upgraded yet, remember, you can go to their website and get upgrade pricing. So head over there, upgrade PDF Pen, or get your copy of PDF Pen or PDF Pen Pro 6 today. And also, while you're at it, don't forget they have PDF Pen for the iPhone and the iPad. So you can get those versions and take your documents on the go with you. And because you have Dropbox syncing, Evernote syncing, iCloud syncing, you can have access when and where you need it, and great tools for editing and working with those PDFs. So PDF Pen Pro 6 from Smile, another great update to an already great lineup of products. And make sure when you're over at smilesoftware.com that you check out all their other stuff as well. They just make great tools. Text Expander, I could go on for days, and I won't do that to you, but check it all out. And a big thank you to Smile for their continued support of the MacCast. And with that, let's get to our interview. You know, a lot of people have talked about the future of learning, moving from traditional textbooks to ebooks on devices like the iPad. Apple believed in it so much. You remember back in January of 2012, they held that whole special event with a bunch of major textbook publishers on board. They also gave us iBooks Author, which is an awesome tool to help create these things. It was going to be the future of textbooks and learning. And since then, there have been some changes, but I don't know that it's quite been the revolution. We haven't hit that revolution stage yet. And you know that I'm involved in the community. I like to get out and get to places where I can talk to other Mac users. I can talk to other iOS users. And I'm in an iOS development group here in San Diego. And I recently had a chance to meet Mark Salata from Works Publishing. And he gave this really great talk to our user group about the applications and the books and stuff that he's building for, or they're building for Works Publishing. And he really believes in this future of digital learning. And so it was great to see someone so excited and passionate about this change. And I wanted to get him on to talk to us and share some of the insights that he shared in that meeting about the future, about what they're working on. We talked about sort of the slow move from traditional textbooks into digital learning, why ebooks and tools like Apple's iBooks Author are a really good start and get us moving in the right direction, but more importantly about why digital learning products need to move a little bit further and how he and Works Publishing are working to go beyond the simple ebook and sort of help drive this digital learning future. And so it was a great conversation, and I'll just dive into it here. I'll share it with you. So here is Mark Salata from Works Publishing. Well, hey, Mark, welcome to the MacCast.
Oh, thank you very much, Adam.
How you doing?
Very good. Very good. Very good to be on the MacCast.
Yeah, thanks for agreeing to come on. So I've already told everybody that you came and spoke to our iOS user group about what you do, and I'll just introduce you. You're Mark Salata with Works Publishing. You have an ebook and digital learning product called Science Works, and I'll let you kind of dive into that a little bit more as we talk about these sorts of things. But I wanted to start out, if you could just tell the MacCast listeners sort of a little bit about your background, what you've been doing, and how you came to be at Works Publishing.
Okay. Well, I started out actually as a biologist, biologist in training, and researcher. However, I always was interested in education, and I turned my training to education for my PhD in science education. And from there, I taught at a college down in Georgia, Gordon State. And then I started doing professional development for teachers. And eventually I met up with some people who were involved with developing software for education. And we put our minds together and developed what is the present day ScienceWorks, what you might call the ebook apps or applications that would be the digital replacement for textbooks.
Okay, so that was sort of how you moved into Works Publishing. So for people who maybe aren't familiar with Works Publishing and the products that you make, can you tell us a little bit about Works Publishing and what you guys are trying to do?
Sure. Works Publishing is a company that's based in San Diego, California. And our product line, ScienceWorks, is, you know, at this time, going from textbooks to digital, it's kind of nebulous what you call it.
Right.
There are things out there called ebooks, but when you say the word ebook, people have various ideas of what it is. It could be as little as what I would call a digitized textbook, maybe a PDF, which surely is not something that I don't think anybody would really think is as significant with the power of what you can do with a computer or a tablet. Why would you just make, you know, a copy, digital copy of it? But ours are ebook apps. They're applications that are downloaded to the computer or tablet, and they include all kinds of media and all, like, animations, simulations, video, images, various interactive assets that you can have combined into an application, which is kind of a book format, but it definitely is not a textbook.
Yeah, so you guys are trying to really push and use the technology in ways that are taking advantage of that. And that was something when you came to the group you talked about a little bit. And I want to maybe back up a little bit, because you kind of gave us a good overview when you started your presentation about sort of the way traditional textbook learning kind of works. Mm-hmm. And I was wondering if you could share with people just who maybe aren't as familiar, you know, sort of what, you know, traditional textbook learning sort of follows a model. And, you know, the technology that you're trying to implement with Works Publishing and just through digital learning products really can take that to another level. And a lot I think the current products out there really aren't doing that. So can you kind of talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, no problem. So you're in the classroom and you have traditional textbooks, and you use traditional textbooks, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My entire schooling. We didn't have any of these great digital products yet.
These fancy things. Yes.
Yeah, we had computers, and CD-ROMs. I mean, you might even hint on that.
You had CD-ROMs?
Yeah, we had CD-ROMs.
Oh my god. Yeah. We had the ten inch discs. Do you remember those?
I do not remember those.
Oh my god, I'm showing my age. I actually had a cassette tape from my hard drive, if you will.
We had some of those too. Those computers where you'd go to a cassette tape. Uh-huh.
Yep. I had to load up my basic program for like 10 minutes before I could even play around with it. In the classroom, traditional textbook learning is really, it's very passive. The textbook itself really supports a teacher-centered classroom.
Right.
You know, you sit there in the room, you're like, okay, let's turn the page such and such on the chapter, let's review that. It's very static. The textbooks are outdated at the moment they're actually published. They're very expensive. And the thing that we were most interested in for Works Publishing was, I did professional development for teachers in Hong Kong, Singapore, and the US, and the focus of that was to try to transform the classroom into what would be called an inquiry-based learning classroom. So it's student-centered. Students get projects, they get to think about the subject. They work with each other in groups. And the traditional classroom is where the teacher is in the front of the classroom and the students are just listening to that teacher going over the board, going through the text step by step, page by page. And so the traditional textbook really pushes that teacher-centered mode. And what we're trying to do is transform actually human interactions in the classroom by leveraging the capabilities that are contained within the tablet and the computers for all this interactive media. And that's what we're actually going after. So if our goal is to make it a student-centered classroom, we aren't going to replicate a traditional textbook like just making a PDF.
Right.
Onto a screen, because that's what you're doing. You're just making a very expensive, you're using a very expensive piece of hardware, which has greater capabilities than the computer that was sent to the moon, and you're not taking advantage of it. I mean, if the computers had feelings, they'd be insulted.
That's a good point.
And so I think maybe the computers are happy using our apps. They feel that they're using all their muscles for helping us humans interact and learn. And so that's what our goal was, and that's, I think we've achieved the first level of that. That's far beyond any other competitor that's tried to do this, because frankly they're just using a little bit of the media here and there, animations and stuff, but it's not a really tight, threaded application all for one unit.
Right. Yeah. Well, so let's talk a little bit about the transition, because I mentioned CD-ROMs, and that seems like really primitive technology at this point. But I mean, with computers and technology, for many, many years, there have been lots of attempts at sort of transitioning from traditional textbooks to some sort of digital media. So, what's your sort of sense of, like, why hasn't some of that stuff worked? And even to today, you mentioned, you have different people taking a different approach. Is everything from just taking a book and converting it to a PDF and calling that a digital learning product or an ebook, all the way through more of the kinds of things that you're sort of doing? So can you talk a little bit about maybe some of the technologies and approaches, and maybe why you think to date, some of those other approaches just haven't worked, or just haven't, really created this revolution? Because I think Apple and Tim Cook, and when Apple released their, and we'll talk a little bit about iBooks Author and some of the things that you played around with that, and maybe some of the challenges there. But Apple did this big publishing event, I think about a year ago, and I don't remember if you saw that. They were in New York, and they had the book publishers out there. They had the big textbook publishers saying, we're going to create this stuff on the iPad, and it's going to revolutionize ebook learning. And I don't think that's happened, right?
Right. It's in its early stages, and but I think there are certain things that have limited past pushes for, if you will, a revolution in the classroom using digital products. And mainly, I think it's really the vision of the creator of those products, or the creators of those products, and the vision typically starts from content being the primary focus. Mm-hmm. So if I want to teach students, say, like for example, we have the free computer app that's downloaded from our website called Nutrition in Humans. And if I want to teach Nutrition in Humans, what do I have to cover? They have to cover the content of, let's see, digestive system, maybe enzymes, and all the various parts, working parts, if you will, of the physiology and anatomy. And that's their focus, is content. So they're thinking of it more like an encyclopedia. And then they say, okay, let's package that encyclopedia in a nice, pretty way, and say on the CD-ROM, you might get a nice thing like that. And that's how it's distributed. But the thing is that they're missing the point. The point is not content. I mean, if I want content, especially now, if I want content, if I want to know the parts of the digestive system, I'll do a Google search. I'll look on Wikipedia.
Sure. Yeah.
And you know, that's not really where you're going to transform education. Where you're going to transform education is to align it with what we know is best for learning. One of the reasons actually is the more recent, the last 20 years or so, maybe 30 years, there's been a great amount of research in science education that shows what really works for learning and what works for students to be actively learning and to be critically thinking. And it's those who apply those ideas to their digital product that are going to be successful, that are going to have an advantage. And right now, I think the mode is for most digital products is to replicate a textbook, which is a tome of content, or it's an encyclopedia, and it's given in a very linear fashion, as if the students are going to take page one information, stick it into their head, and then go to page two, stick that into their head, in a very factory-like way of learning.
Right.
That's boring as hell. Pardon me, but
yeah.
But come on, I mean, Adam, what time when you actually said, as a student, "Wow, I'm really learning this, and I love it. I want to do more." When did you do that as a student?
Well, you do that when you're actually in the classroom and participating, and there could be multiple ways to do that. But for me, it was very much anytime we were doing hands-on things, anytime we were in groups where we were interacting with the teacher, with maybe if it's a science experiment, you know, actual physical things, and then you're seeing things happen, you're asking questions, and there's an interaction, right? At least for me.
Exactly. And that pretty much sums up a bunch of the research, saying, you know, that's the kind of thing that really gets students to learn and learn for the long term.
Right.
You know, if you change the classroom to be student-centered and you do it right, I mean, it's not like you say, okay, teacher, do it student-centered and therefore you're going to just do it right without any training or some experience of the subtleties of it. But if you do have the training and you go through it and you think about it more deeply as an educator, you start finding out that it really does work for long term. A teacher does a demonstration. I was always excited when I had in a physics class when it was a demonstration time.
Right.
The reason why is because the teacher would do the demonstration. He wouldn't tell you what the answer was from the beginning. He'd say, okay, I'm going to show you something and tell me what you think. And it was this idea that my thoughts were important and I have an opportunity to see something new and apply what my prior experiences were, whether they were academic or just at home, and then start asking questions. And then, you know, it's kind of like digging for treasure. So the digital product has to kind of replicate that in some form or fashion. And so for our apps, the first few pages, if you will, are introductory. They are demonstrations. They are having the students ask questions without giving any answers. And the idea is that the next several pages after will provide you some more information that you will dig through in an exploratory way, such that you'll come back to it at the end of the ebook app, if you will. And then you can either get the answer within it. You can either get the answer yourself because you can figure it out, or it will push you to ask questions of your classmates and have a discussion with them. And then you together, collaboratively, come up with the answer to that interesting thing at the beginning.
Right. Right.
So that's, I think that's one of the reasons why, old forms of digital stuff wasn't as powerful as it could be, or the ones that are out there now aren't as powerful as they could be, because they're focused on content and they're not thinking about pedagogy, how students learn, and how do you arrange that content. That is essential. The context is the most important thing. And yes, content is very important, but context is very important, because students need things to be relevant to their lives. If it's not relevant to their lives, they're going to tune out. And it can't be just some cutesy thing that you know, a bell and a whistle. It really has to hit their heart to want to learn it. So
that's the sort of thing that you're trying to integrate into your products, and that you really mm-hmm. feel is going to help facilitate and push these types of products forward. Do you have a sort of an example you could share with us of that idea of context, maybe even from one of your products?
I'm thinking of the one that we have as a free download, and I'm laughing.
Sure.
When the team put together, the product has a framework. It's based on what's called the 5E model. Mm-hmm. Okay, this is an instructional model from education, science education. In fact, my colleague Roger Bybee and his colleagues over at BSCS in Colorado Springs developed it. And this instructional model has gone worldwide. And people sometimes know it as the 5E, or if you say what the five, it's E's, it's five words that start with E.
Right.
And the first one is engage. And so when you're having instruction, you have to engage the students. And what that means is you have to engage them with their something that's relevant to them, prior experiences, and something that gets them to start asking questions. Well, I'm laughing because our team put together for the nutrition and humans on the second page that the engage shows... It shows a boy standing in a library, and another boy approaches him and stands next to him, looking at the other's bookcase opposite him, and he bends down to go get the book at the lower level, while the other boy is standing up, and the one standing up farts.
Yeah,
and he farts, and it shows this green puff of smoke coming from him, and the one that was down taking it in passes out.
So it's a funny video.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was just in San Antonio for the National Science Teachers Association meeting, and I have video of this one teacher, a teacher, mind you, I'm who played that. I played that for him. He just about lost it laughing.
Yeah.
And he kept playing it about five times. He said, one more time. He's ready to pass out. At first I was kind of disgusted by it, but I'm thinking, no, actually middle school students.
Flatulence is funny no matter what your age is.
Yeah, it is. But it's relevant, right?
And it's also relevant, exactly, yes.
Nutrition in humans. You know, if you said to a student, we're going to cover nutrition in humans, let's begin with amylase that's in your mouth. Isn't it kind of cool that you can eat a cracker and it tastes sweet after you chew it a while? No. Flatulence is relevant. So that's one of the key engage to begin with. And what's important with it is not just to get that is that funny kind of factor, but that is truly relevant. It is part of nutrition in humans. And then what comes up after that animation are key questions to focus them on, okay, this is what happened in the animation. You know, what causes flatulence? Right. How does nutrition affect that? And then it leads you into more content, the content of the book. And that's one example. And so far, every teacher, when they look at that, they go, yep, that's relevant for the students, and they will get it. Some of them aren't as drastic as that.
Sure. Yeah.
But
people get the idea from that. I mean, you can use that as the example of, you know, this is how you're going to draw them in. And like you said, engage them, get their attention, and then lead them into asking questions and diving deeper and what have you.
And then other parts in that same book, like it asks questions. It's kind of like, what do you know about dieting? What are the myths of dieting? That's something like that. One of the teachers said that our apps seem kind of like more like a magazine, mm-hmm. because they're approachable. They have various things that are very interesting for and relevant for students on various pages. But at the same time, they have the content that teachers need and teachers or students should want to learn about. But it's a very appealing way it's set up.
Right. And it seems like your products, correct me if I'm wrong, but are very much to be used in the classroom, mm-hmm. you know, with students and teachers engaging along with the products. Mm-hmm. What's your thought on digital learning products, you know, being, can they exist in a vacuum? Do they work in that environment? Or do you really need, you know, a teacher, an instructor, a parent or somebody else there to really help facilitate this stuff as well?
Well, ours are created that they could be done by the students themselves. Mm-hmm. So if, say, the teachers, there's this phenomenon going on in education called flipping the classroom. And it's basically the traditional lecture that they would have. Teachers would maybe record that lecture and put it on YouTube or some safe place, and the students would watch that at home. And then when they come into the classroom, they actually do the hands-on experiments in the classroom, and they don't get lecture in the classroom.
Interesting.
The teachers, and it's getting to be very popular. I kind of did something like this when I taught, but I didn't have the terminology for it. So our product can be, the students can take it home. They can work on it at home on a computer or a tablet. It's not web-based. It's downloaded. So once it's downloaded, you don't have to worry about the internet. That's actually one thing. Most of the major publishers have their stuff on the web. So some teachers are having issues with other products at schools when they don't have a very strong internet connection.
Yeah, which isn't a common problem at all, right? And I'm being sarcastic. I know a lot of educators, and I know a lot of people, you know, they come to our user group and they work in education, and the network's a constant problem for them.
Absolutely. And maybe 5 years from now, a greater number of schools will have enough, but I think it's going to be a constant issue probably. As applications or as content gets bigger and bigger, I mean, it's still going to have more bandwidth it's going to have to take up.
Sure.
The way our product can be used, the students can be given it in a small group, say in the corner of a room, if they want to rotate through it. All the students can use it at the same time. The teacher can present it up at the front of the classroom if they want. However, it really shouldn't be just the teacher standing up there showing the application and going through it.
Right.
Because that kills the whole purpose of its design. But they can do it as a review. They can use it for the engage. Maybe they start the engage part of it and share it with everybody and say, okay, now you guys get into the rest of the application that you have on your hardware. So there's various ways to do it. But it's definitely student-centered product. Teachers don't have to be there. However, I think the idea that teachers are not needed anymore is kind of a silly idea for me, because I see education as not just getting that content
right
into the student. We're talking about human relationships. So there's a lot more to be taught in school. And, you know, you're taught perseverance, you're taught diligence, assertiveness, tact, and all of these various, if you want to call them virtues, those are taught by human interactions. Those aren't taught by a computer application telling the student, okay, this is what diligence is. You have to experience it. You have to collaborate with people, and you learn all those subtleties of what it is to be a human being through a model, and that model is the teacher.
Yeah. I talk about my show a lot, not just from a teaching perspective, but I'm often concerned that with internet and technology, sometimes people tend to lose sight of the fact of, you know, these human interactions along with the technology are much more powerful together than just one or the other alone. I think that the two complement each other. And specifically, I talk about, you know, community in terms of learning computer technology. So I'll meet people, go, I can Google everything I need to know online. I said, but have you been to a meetup? Have you been to a group, you know, like the iOS group that I met you at? You know,
right.
That would not have happened. We would not be having this conversation had I not gone and interacted there. So that would have been, in my mind, a missed opportunity. I wouldn't have learned about the things you've been able to come on and share with us, you know, shared with me there and are now sharing here. So, you know, that's learning, right?
And the feedback that you know, I gave the talk, and the feedback I was getting at during the talk and after the talk and networking, right. All of that is non-existent if I just presented that talk on the internet.
On YouTube, yeah.
Yeah, it just wasn't going to happen.
Yeah, so that's very, very important. I guess the last thing, just on the textbooks, you know, the transition to digital learning products, and are you finding challenges in terms of, we all know that schools' budgets are tight and things mm-hmm. like that, and technology tends to be expensive. Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges surrounding that as part of this transition for you, or have you experienced, and how do you deal with those sorts of things?
Well, I mean, I can't. Well, one way we've handled it is that our products, we have applications for computers.
Mm-hmm.
So Nutrition in Humans is available for computers and Windows and Mac OS, and we also have the equivalent application Nutrition in Humans available for the iPad, so for iOS, and once we put it up there, it'll be on Google Play for Android OS. So we're kind of hitting the major hardware pieces. So I think I'm not too worried. You know, if most schools have one of those things or both of those things, tablets or computers.
Sure.
There are schools in which, you know, I've had teachers come up to an exhibit booth and said, you know what? I said, do you have computers? And they go, no. I said, do you have a computer? And they're like, yeah, I'm the only one that has a computer. But that's not the majority. And the majority have multiple computers, or at the very least, they have a computer lab.
Right.
At a minimum. So I'm not too worried about that. One thing that's a concern for the teachers or the schools is that a bunch of them have invested in computers over the last several years. And now the big push is tablets, which definitely is a different form factor and can definitely push, I think the form factor itself can push more towards a student-centered classroom than a regular computer, even a laptop.
Right.
But their concern is, we put in all this money for computers, and the last several years, and now we're going to get tablets. Are we going to now not use the computers? And for a lot of things, the answer may be yes, because the software is stuck to only one particular hardware.
Right.
So our advantage is we have it on both of those kinds of hardware.
On multiple platforms. So that's actually probably a good transition. Let's talk a little bit about, just from a high level, about the process for development. And you said the company you started when?
Works Publishing officially about 2 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so did you, tablets were around then. Were you originally just developing for desktop, or did you go right into desktop tablet, all the way across the board? How did you guys start up, and how did you begin the whole, what was the first product that you guys shipped?
Well, originally desktop was it. And we were pushing out the desktop format, which would be a download to your Mac or your Windows.
Mm-hmm.
And then that was going well, but because tablets were growing, you and I are probably going to look back maybe 20, 30 years and tell grandchildren whatever and say, yes, I remember the day when the iPad was released.
Yeah.
And all these naysayers were making jokes, and they had a skit on SNL, and then the grandchildren would say, well, what's SNL?
They'll say, what's an iPad?
Yeah, exactly. What's an iPad? Steve Jobs. bite my tongue, right? So the tablet was there and very appealing form factor for what our pedagogical goals were.
Right.
And I would I'd been hearing rumors about the iBooks author being released or something like that, right? They didn't have a name. I search on a bunch of different Mac following groups that have tons of rumors. A couple of days before it was announced, the big announcement for iBooks authoring the tool, I told my folks, okay, guys, get ready. Don't clear your schedule, because there's something that's coming, and we got to start making these things with it. And as soon as it came out, I was very excited. But we looked at it, and we actually have six iBooks that are there, or seven actually, one free in the iBook store, and Apple is very happy with them, and we're happy with them as well. However, there are limitations of what you can do with it. The format for iBooks authoring tool is very much like a textbook. It encourages you to do that. So in order for us to do our interactive stuff that we had to do some coding and put layers on top of the normal pages. So to get what we wanted. And we weren't really getting exactly what we wanted, but it was some semblance of what we had for the desktops. And we had schools buying hundreds of copies of stuff, and they really love it. They really love it. But we have a better we believe we have a better, and actually teachers believe, after I showed them in the exhibit, a better product through making it as an app, because we have more control. Our creative capacities can be utilized. And one thing that iBooks Author wouldn't allow you to do is to make it for Android tablets.
Right.
And also the other thing is we have this learning management tool that is layered seamlessly on top of ScienceWorks. And iBooks authoring tool wouldn't allow you to do that really either. So
interact with that. So you hit some limitations. What were some of the things? Were there some things that iBooks author did allow you to do that were pretty cool. Seamless and
Oh yeah, I mean, if you get any, I was say it's an iBook. They don't want you to call it an iBook. It's an ebook, but it's anyway. It's an iBook. Going through the multiple pages, taking a look at and skipping to a page is very nice and clean. The flow of the swiping action is very nice and clean. Of course, the pinch form for videos and images is very nice and clean.
Right.
But It's made for, they've got, you can put images, video, and you can put quizzes in very, very quickly. You know, multiple choice stuff where you get a yes.
Kind of
you know.
Easy quiz, yeah.
It's all very, very nice, but it's very basic for, and it's more akin to a textbook.
Right, it's very structured, and it's very, you know, the designs, well, you can tweak the designs, you're sort of given a template, right, and you follow this right. template of sections and stuff like that. So for somebody who wants to put something together quickly with some, what I would call moderate amount of interaction, right? Mm-hmm. Right. It can be done. And if you want to do more advanced things, I know they have tools like you can do some stuff with Keynote and JavaScript exactly. scripting and a little bit of coding.
You can use Keynote as a sort of like a Flash develop thing. You know,
right.
That's what they told us. It's really a Keynote for making an ebook, which I think is great for example, I saw a teacher give it to their students to make an ebook, and they came up with very nice stuff. And I think that's a very good thing for the students to create. There's school districts that are schools that are telling the teachers, okay, now you make, so you can get iBooks Author, it's free, now you make the book. And
top of everything else they have to do, and we you know, with the right. you know, and I'm assuming they're not getting an extra salary to write ebooks.
Go change the world. By the way, make an iBook. But you know, there's a lot that's involved with this. I mean, all right. the assets, all the organization. This is not something simple to do. I think it's great for students to do because they have some production stuff and they have to learn of all these. They can do collaboration. They learn about how it is to go through from a blank template to a final product. That in itself is a lesson, but for a teacher to do it, it's like, wait a minute, you know, there's publishers out there that do that. And
I equate this a lot to, this is something that Apple has done to us historically over the years, mm-hmm. in many realms, starting with, you know, desktop publishing. I came from a graphic design background, and I remember the days when, oh, here's a Mac and here's PageMaker. Now everybody can, you know, design their own flyers and ads and, We don't need these professionals anymore because we've got this tool. And look, Apple showed us it's really easy, right?
They did. I mean, their stuff is nice, but I mean, imagine, PowerPoint. I mean, right. Everybody thinks they can do a presentation because PowerPoint's out there.
Right.
I mean, now Keynote, much cleaner and nicer, but still, it doesn't mean that you can do a great presentation. And it doesn't mean that you're going to put a nice design layout on it that people, it's going to be appealing. I mean, there are reasons why there's you know, classes for this stuff. And
right, exactly. Yeah, I mean, you still need to have the core disciplines and skills and things like that to go along. These are all tools. And it's right. funny because we get these new tools and people think if I have the right hammer, I'm a carpenter. Or if I just have the right.
Exactly.
But it you learn after practice, it doesn't work that way. And I think then we all come to our senses. So again, it seemed like iBooks Author, and I think you kind of discovered this. It's just going to be this big, you know, Apple put it out as this big revolution. Mm-hmm. And it is an amazing tool, and people can do amazing things with it. But they still need to have the core skill sets. And they also need to know, it sounds like your engineers, you know, are the same thing. Mm-hmm. They discover where the limitations are and then go, okay, now we need to go for what we want to accomplish and what we know we want to do. This is where we cut it off and say, we got to go to the next level. We got to do a native app that'll allow us to do the things that we want to do.
Right. And Apple, as Apple's talked to me and said, you know, would you want to make more? I'm like, yeah, I will. We'll keep it open. And they said that the iBooks authoring tool is going to be updated. And
sure.
That's fine. But you got to also remember that when the iBooks Author came out, it was brought out with some major publishers, and I won't mention who.
Right.
You can find out your own, but there are major publishers that are out there that really helped push this forward. And they have their own axe to grind. They publish hard copy stuff. They are doing digital. Most of it's online. But they really don't have that much of an incentive to go digital as quickly as maybe we would want to. So of course, I would imagine the iBooks authoring tool would be more like a textbook. They wouldn't want it to be very different because if it that I would imagine they'd be fearful that if it was very different and it was appealing to people, that would make their textbooks look even worse.
Yeah.
And they would, oh my God, you know, that we're making a huge distinction between our hard copy product and this digital product, and everybody's going after the digital product, and then quickly the textbook dies. Which, for them, of course, that's their bread and butter. So I can understand that tug and pull from a major publisher's perspective.
Sure. Sure. So let's talk a little bit then about sort of where you think we are and maybe where we're going. Mm-hmm. You know, obviously Works Publishing, you're invested in this sort of new approach to learning, new approach to, I don't, you know, we want to call them textbook, digital learning products, ebooks, whatever we're going to, what is the term you like to use? I guess I probably should ask you that from the very beginning.
Well, I mean, I a couple months ago, I liked to use the phrase ebook app, but right. But then I started realizing that the word ebook is kind of tainted with this, sometimes with a, you know, as a digital copy of a. Of
yeah, some people just think it's PDF.
Yeah, exactly. So now I don't know what the hell to call it. I mean, it's a Works app. Maybe that's what it is. We'll find out.
Right.
You know, once we, you know, take over the whole digital realm of this sector, then we'll come up with a really nice name and register it.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, that you've got the product out there, you've been able to take it to a certain point. Where mm-hmm. is it at now, and what kinds of things do you think you're going to be able to hopefully add to it in the future, if you can talk about that stuff? I guess I should probably ask that too.
Yeah, you should say that. I'll be
just from a real general standpoint. Yeah. So, you know, we talked about, I guess, that, you know, you've got textbooks that they're just adding interactive content to, maybe, and right. you know, that's an iBooks author thing. You've obviously gone further than that, and you have more interaction in your apps and things like that. Right. You know, what other kinds of things could potentially be put in there, I guess,
What's coming in the future?
Yeah. And just for all, you know, just this entire category, if you want to talk more broadly.
It's just between you and me, right? I think I've watched almost every presentation and interview that Steve Jobs did. So I'm going to take some lessons learned from him.
Right.
I'll share. So the future I see is that we're going to push this idea of getting the human interactions,
there you go,
leveraging those more and more and more, leveraging the individual interaction with the digital product. And for example, when you're thinking of a digital product, or let's say textbook is as static as it can be, okay?
Right.
It is fixed. So your interaction with a textbook is what it is. It's not changing. And so I think one of the next steps is that digital product has the possibility of becoming dynamic. And I'll leave it to your imagination what dynamic could mean.
Sure.
And so that's one area, but also dynamic within collaboration amongst the students within the classroom.
Yeah. I think you're hitting on the key when you said social interaction, right? Because mm-hmm. we already mentioned earlier that you feel, and I feel, and I think a lot of people feel, that that's a key part to the whole learning process, right? The interaction with the teacher, the interaction with your peers, interaction with the content, all of
right.
these things help facilitate learning. And so far from what we've seen, well, textbooks, you know, without a lot of help from a lot of these sources, don't really get the job done. These digital learning products can do a little bit better job, but I think what I see is they're on their way, but they're not there yet, right? We haven't
right.
seen anybody really implementing that kind of interaction, at least at the levels that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, I agree, and it is not merely integrating Facebook to the product.
Right. It's not putting a Twitter share button in, right?
Right.
Hey, I got the right answer on this quiz.
Exactly, and you know, there's some people that do that in the product, and they go, "Look, you can go to Facebook." Wow, really? How long did it take you to think up that? I mean, seriously. When in our discussions, you know, if there was someone in the group that in our group who thought that was one of the most creative things we can do, that is a red flag for them to consider maybe moving on. But yeah, that's where we're going, and I think in the next 5 years, you're going to see some very, very interesting ways that digital world is going to be leveraged to do what we just talked about, increase those social interactions and utilize all we know about what's best for learning from an education standpoint in the product itself.
Oh, very cool. That sounds like a future that I wish I was growing up learning in.
Yeah.
We still did okay. We still did okay, though, I think.
Yeah, I didn't mind sitting at my computer programming for hours on end.
Yeah, I had my Apple IIe. Yeah, so that was my foray into technology and hands on learning.
Apple IIe. I had a Texas Instrument. Was it 99-4A?
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah. Trash 80s at school, man.
I think our school's first computers were Commodore PETs, and then, you know, some kids broke in and stole them.
Oh, brilliant. I wonder where they are now. I mean, the kids, not the computers.
Well, I think they got caught, and they got the computers. They weren't geniuses. I think they were sixth graders, so whatever.
Well, the geniuses were able to do some other stuff and became hackers later on.
Exactly. Well, Mark, I want to really thank you for coming on and sharing your insights on this topic and telling us a little bit about Works Publishing. If people want to get more information about your products, it sounds like you got a free one that they can download and try. Where should they go, and you know, what kind of contact information and stuff like that do you have?
Okay. Well, thank you for having me on, by the way, first of all. But the website is www.works, that's WERKZ publishing, all one word, .com. And you can just follow the breadcrumb trail, if you will, for the free download for the computer version of Nutrition in Humans. And that will work on a Mac as well as Windows OS. I don't know, do you have any people listening that use
very
Windows?
Likely, yes. So we have teachers and educators. I'm sure many of them have Windows machines in their classrooms and things.
Well,
like
if
that,
they and if they want to, if any teachers want to take a look at any of the other computer based versions of the other apps, they can contact us on our contact us page and request like a 1 day or 2 day trial for those other ones.
Great.
So feel free to do that. And the good news is Apple is accepting our apps one after another. We've got I think 5 in now. They're going to have probably 5 in this week and 5 in the next week. So we're rapidly having all the apps on the tablets, the iPad first.
So you can find those on the App Store, and just searching for Works, the easiest way to find those?
Works Publishing, yes. The ones that are available right now are for education. So they'll need to have an education subscription. So they'd have to contact us to actually unlock the content. So for retail purposes, we have one of them up there, but I'm not so sure that people in retail would want to pay what we have for the price up there. It's really made for the schools right now. That's what we're focusing.
Great. Okay. Great. Well, people should check it out. And again, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Adam. Take care.
So there you go, Mark Salata from Works Publishing. I had a great time chatting with Mark, both at that iOS user group meeting and also just during this conversation that we just listened to. And I really think that there's a lot of potential in this technology. And I think that there's a lot of unrealized potential. So I would be curious if you are an educator, if you're someone working in this field and you have something to add to this conversation, you know, the lines are always open. You can send me feedback, maccast@gmail.com. I welcome your audio comments. Call in on the listener hotline, get in touch however you want, and let us know what you think is happening and going on with respect to ebooks and digital learning and the kind of the future of these devices. How are we going to see them more integrated into the classroom? How do we get this stuff to work and really change and revolutionize the way that we're learning? And I really like this concept or this idea about extending virtually and digitally the social interactions that we can have with this stuff and opening that up. And I really think that hasn't realized its full potential yet. So I look forward to hearing what you have to say. But with that, I think that's going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. I want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors, Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software. Get more information and details over at circusponies.com. Smile, check out the new versions of PDF Pen, PDF Pen 6, PDF Pro 6, as well as all of their other great products over at smilesoftware.com. GoToMeeting by Citrix. You can try GoToMeeting free for 30 days. Just visit GoToMeeting.com, click on the Try It Free button, and use the promo code MACCAST. Gazelle, the fast, simple way to sell your used gadgets. Find out what your iPhone, your iPad, MacBook, Samsung Galaxy S, or other smartphone is worth over at Gazelle.com. Squarespace, the beautiful and intuitive website publishing platform that allows anyone to easily create a professional web page, blog, online store, or gallery all on a single platform. You can try it free, no credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com/maccast to sign up now. And when you sign up, you can get 10% off your new account by using the offer code MACCAST4. And then ShareFile by Citrix. Take all the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email, attachments, and FTP by using ShareFile. You can try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to sharefile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my promo code MACCAST. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the show. Big thank you to you for listening, for staying subscribed. Please keep your emails and your audio comments coming. I love hearing from you. I look forward to your feedback every week. You can send your feedback to maccast@gmail.com, or you can call in on the listener hotline, leave a voicemail. That's 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. Or you can call in on Skype. The Skype address is the MacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can go to the website. That's at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. You can also follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/maccast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page over at facebook.com/themaccast. You can also find me on app.net, on Google Plus, on Appler, if you'd like to see what kind of apps I'm currently enjoying, and any place else, you're likely going to find me. It's going to be MacCast. So I look forward to seeing you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.